This is the Unknown Strength Podcast. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Brenton.
And I'm your co-host, Mac.
So as always, this is the podcast that's dedicated to talking with interesting minds across the realms of martial arts, fighting, strength training, and all things performance related. So today, on episode number 16, we talk to Sai Naji, the man behind the fighting spectacles that are Rebellion Muay Thai, Roots, and the Jiu-Jitsu tournament close to my very own heart, Boa Super 8. He's the owner, the manager, the matchmaker and promoter through his very own Outliers Promotions. He's also a fight trainer and the owner of Melbourne-based gyms, William Street Gym and Box on North. Today, we had a chat around his ascent through the fight world, through his own productions, as well as his foray into the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu world, with the fourth edition of Boa 8 coming up on June 23rd, which will be featuring some enormous names in the sport, people you'll know, such as Craig Jones, Australian world beater, Gilbert Burns from the UFC, James Brasco, Mike Perez,
DJ Jackson,
just to name a few.
Totally.
Before we begin, just want to thank some of our sponsors who help contribute to this show and make it possible. Thank you to MMA Fight Store over at www.mmafightstore.com.au. They've also got a new store located in Concord, Sydney's Inner West. And as far as I know, our listeners are treated really well. So go in, check out the store, and check out specifically the latest range of King's Gis, which I have a complete unbiased opinion on, as well as their other tatami range, Hayabusa. They've got some awesome stuff in there. We also want to thank JT Tenacity. Head over to www.jiu-go.com. It's a submission-based card game, and as I like to say, for people who like to choke their friends and submit their foes. They also have a golden ticket promotion. Those who draw the number one or number 500 will receive a cash prize.
And next on our list of thanks is Melbourne band Killed by Technology. Eddie and the boys were good enough to donate their latest single, Unsociable Behaviour, to us to be the theme song on this show. That's the song you hear at the intro and the outro of the show. So hope you guys are enjoying that. And our brand new, our latest sponsor, Gripedo. That's www.gripedo. The Gripedo is a terrific training tool which enables you to train your grip. It's got a shape that kind of makes it difficult and challenging in different ways for the grip, which translates specifically over to grappling grip and combat sports grip. So in an upcoming episode, I'm going to be reviewing the Gripedo. So I've had one for a couple of weeks now. I've done a whole bunch of stuff with it, and I'm really enjoying it. But there is an exercise I have not had a chance to do with it yet, and it involves a bucket of sand. So without giving out too many details on that, you're going to have to listen to the episode with the review of the Gripedo. So stay tuned. Is there anything else we've got to go through before we get into the interview?
I think you covered that, so let's just get into the episode.
All right, let's do it. Thanks for listening, everybody, and enjoy.
Fantastic. Welcome, Sai. Really good to have you on the show.
Thanks, Brenton. Thanks, Mac.
Thank you, buddy.
So, Sai, you've been in and around the fight game for a really long time now. It seems like you're just continuously growing an empire, and you've got some new way to deliver and give something to the fans in Australia and around the world. So firstly, how did it all begin? What got you into the fight game?
Enter the Dragon, man.
Enter the Dragon.
Like most people my age, I was born in the late 70s and Bruce Lee was still a thing before Hoist Gracie was a thing. So I was obsessed with karate when I was a kid in Iran. And I remember we were going to go and do a friend of mine's parent, dad was a karate instructor. I remember the day we were going to go do karate and we were walking out the door. I remember this so clearly, walking out the door and the phone rings. It's my uncle from Australia and he's like, oh, you guys should move to Australia. And my mom and dad are like, literally, we're halfway out the door.
How old are you at this time?
7 years old.
7 years old.
7 years old. And I'm like, this is the greatest thing. Me and my brother, who's 11 at that stage, we're going to go do karate. And it doesn't end up happening. That they're like, well, what's the point of starting something new? We're going to move to Australia. So that all went on. It went on hold. And then I remember a few years later, before we came here, we'd sold our house. And I remember going back to see the new owners. And I walked in. And I remember so clearly our front yard. There was a punching bag hanging. It's the first time I'd ever seen a punching bag in my life. I remember it so clearly. I was like, this looks pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then probably when I was like 12, 13 years old, watching Enter the Dragon again, and man, I was obsessed. Like, I nagged my parents for 3 months. I didn't speak to my dad for a month until they let me start doing martial arts. I was obsessed. Everything I did at school, every essay, every assignment, every artwork we did had something to do with martial arts in it, until they let me do it. And I was a good student, but I made sure I was an extra good student just so they could let me keep doing it.
Right.
Yeah.
Excellent. So obviously at this time, was there any kind of dominant martial arts that was grabbing your attention? I know there's so many variations. I mean, in today's day and age as a jiu-jitsu guy, you know, you've got Brazilian jiu-jitsu, but then you hear things like Carlson Gracie jiu-jitsu and you know, the Gracie jiu-jitsu, and so many variations. Was there one you were fixating on?
Well, at that stage, like this is 1991. So it was still karate and sort of taekwondo, ninjutsu, that sort of stuff. And the thing that was probably the closest, and I guess even back then, with the limited amount of marketing, was marketed the best, was taekwondo.
Right.
So we went there, and my parents took me to a taekwondo club, Juno's Taekwondo in East Doncaster. And I remember my first class. And we went in there, and at that stage, you know, everyone's idea of fighting was stand-up fighting and kicking and punching. And, you know, I think we did like two classes of wrestling at high school, because we had a Canadian PE teacher who showed us some wrestling, which was awesome. It was Taekwondo. And there was no like YouTube and internet and stuff that you're like researching things. So, yeah, I got into Taekwondo, and I was like as obsessive as you can get with something. I mean, I had a Korean flag hanging in my room. It was like that level of obsession.
Amazing.
Yeah, and every day we had a punching bag in the backyard. I used to train 1 day of the week in classes, and then 2.5 hours a day in the backyard.
Like, yeah.
Seriously obsessive.
I love it.
Yeah, I remember I went to an international school for high school, and I remember I watched so many martial arts movies that by the time I was so excited about high school, because I thought I'm going to get to learn from some of the greatest like martial arts fighters in the world, and I was just obsessed with it, thinking about the amount of opportunities I was going to get. I mean, as far as your own martial arts journey, you started off in karate, you've moved to taekwondo, you know, you're even managing, owning, promoting, you have Rebellion, Muay Thai, you have Roots, you have Boa, which we're going to go into soon. To start with, how did Rebellion, Muay Thai and Roots begin?
Yeah, so through all the years, obviously I went from taekwondo and then like shoot boxing with John Will in sort of 95, 96, and then I met Lao Stui, who became my Muay Thai trainer when I was really young.
Right.
So you guys would know Lao pretty
yep.
well. And then I went back off and just went into Olympic wrestling, came back into striking martial arts and stuff, and years later I opened my first gym, and then my second gym. When I started, I was only teaching boxing, and I used to call it kickboxing because I just didn't feel like what I was showing was really Muay Thai.
Right.
And we ended up hiring a couple of Thai trainers, and they just sort of happened to come into my life. So Jojo, who's still around in Melbourne, mm-hmm. and then Ton and Jump, who still work with me years later. And I used to always go to fight shows. So back in the day, Christopher Cronus used to promote Stand a Man Longanides, used to fight, and, you know, at the Glass House, there'd be 10,000 people. I'd go to those shows, and it was a big deal. And I had him into fight shows per se for a while because of the wrestling thing, and then I've been back into the scene. And I remember going to one of the fight shows. We were meant to have a fight, but it pulled out, and I took my two Thai trainers with me. And I remember the show started, and I just saw their faces, and they looked like, what the hell is this? And I remember, like,
in
actually...
In a bad way.
And I was like, yeah, so this is Muay Thai in Australia.
This is what we've got.
Yeah, this is the best we've got. And I sort of thought, you know, back then all the fight promotions were a mix. So you'd go there, there'd be two kickboxing fights, one K1 fight, mm-hmm. one Muay Thai fight, back to a kickboxing
right.
fight.
So Muay Thai would almost be like a special rules fight. That wouldn't be an exclusive Muay Thai event.
No, and I think like Jep had done Muay Thai shows, but still like Muay Thai with shin guards and this and that. And George Colobus was doing Brute Force, but, you know, they'd still put a karate fight on or a boxing fight on. And I just went onto this thing, we're just going to do a Muay Thai one, because we had Muay Thai at our gym. I had friends who had Muay Thai gyms. So I'm like, we're going to do this. And initially I thought, I just want a series that's a regular series, just a basic show. And so we talked about it for ages, and then finally I'm like, okay, I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. And where my second gym, Kaizen, used to be, there was a reception hall, a place across the street, Red Scooter. And I've been talking to that guy that owned it for ages in the street, and I finally said, look, man, can I do a fight show here? And, yeah, so 2011, in December, we did the first Rebellion, and I was like, I always remember that first fight. The first fight started, and these two young guys, and I said, this will be the one where it's all going to be Muay Thai, and there's going to be no shin pads, nothing. It's going to be Muay Thai. And I remember the first fight happened, and Paris, who does all the filming for all our shows, I remember him running downstairs from the sound room and went, this is your first fight? Man, you're onto something good. And the night just got better and better. And then the main event ended up being the fight of the year. It was just this hectic fight between Sam Etney and Kim Johnson.
Wow.
And then the next day, it's just like people going crazy on Facebook and International Kickboxer Forum. It's like, oh, this is really good. And yeah, it just literally from show one to show two, the quality and the standard probably doubled.
Right.
And it just grew, wow. grew. And it's... yeah, it's been like very challenging, but probably the thing that's been sort of most rewarding emotionally and creatively for me, because it's been this thing I've managed to just completely dictate where I want it to go. So, yeah, it's like 30 shows later now. So
amazing. I mean, just from the sounds of it, Muay Thai is relatively young in Australia. I mean, this, you're talking, you know, 10 years ago, sounds like there wasn't really much available for a Muay Thai fighter to fight in that sort of a top-tier organisation in Australia?
In Australia, there was. So in Queensland, it was a very large organisation called Evolution.
Right.
And they were on Foxtel, and their show's probably 2,000, 3,000 people. Melbourne's always had a very old-school kickboxing culture.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys who promoted a sport here all own kickboxing gyms and have kickboxing fighters. The Muay Thai guys, Muay Thai was a real side thing. New South Wales always had really bizarre rules with combat sports. Like, girls couldn't fight boxing and kickboxing until not long ago.
Yeah.
You couldn't fight without shin guards. They had world title fights. Stan the Man and I think Marie Smith was with shin guards. Perth had a strong scene, but Victoria never had it. And then Evo sort of went away about 5-6 years ago. And the Queensland scene's kind of mixed and moved around a bit. There's a lot of smaller events, a couple of big ones, but Victoria never had a prominent Muay Thai thing, and we were never considered a Muay Thai state, whereas now we're probably, you know, we're right up there.
Excellent. I mean, so what is Rebellion Muay Thai?
Originally, I was coming with names, and it was going to be the Muay Thai Rebellion, right? So mm-hmm. It was like we were uprising against all the other stuff. So
yeah. I like it.
I got weird, yeah, little things in my head. I'm like, it's the Muay Thai Rebellion. And I'm like, all these other shows, Muay Thai was the second word. And I'm like, you know, a lot of the kickboxing guys are my friends, and they were helping me as well with my license and stuff. I don't want to be a complete dick about it. So I was like, Rebellion Muay Thai.
Yep.
And a friend of ours, I think, Johnny Kappa, I remember we went and sat down, and he's a branding graphics guy, and we have these really cool chats. We catch up for coffee. I tell him my next stupid idea. Half an hour later, he's got a logo and a brand for me.
Amazing.
Yeah, he's phenomenal.
Yeah, he does some really, really good work. I mean, he's done a lot of, like, the really top cafes in Melbourne.
Mm. And, you know, he basically, literally, we talked about it. 2 hours later, he's like, check your Dropbox. And it's like the Rebellion logo, and I was like, this is sweet.
This is it.
Yeah, yeah. So we had 5 or 6 Rebellions in a row, and they became really big really quickly. So like Rebellion 5 was a $10,000 eight-man, and the guys I had in that eight-man were just phenomenal. Like one of my favorite fighters of all time, Daddy Cool, ended up being the alternate. So like the best guy in Australia is sitting there taped up waiting for someone to fall through. So it became this massive show.
Wow.
And it went quite viral quickly. Like by third or fourth show, I was getting like random messages from people all over Australia and stuff going, we want to come and fight.
Right.
And then so the standard went up, and I was like, shit, now I can't put any newer guys on it. So that's when we came up with Road to Rebellion, which was an opportunity for guys to fight on it and work their way up to Rebellion.
It's like a feeder for Rebellion.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Like a contender series.
You remember Pride used to have Bushido?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Even the UFC has like something like that, like the contender series to get onto the UFC.
Exactly. So I ended up doing that, but then, you know, I'd have, you know, there's only so many times a year you can do shows, and I'd put a date in, and then someone would call me and say, oh, so-and-so is available. And I just, like, the idea of a good matchup, I can't say no to it.
Right.
So the first Road to Rebellion was what it should be. And then between Road to Rebellion 2 and 6, it became this thing where, you know, some of the fights, like I had Toby Smith on Road to Rebellion 5, and Toby Smith's the guy who knocked out John Wayne Parr in two rounds, right?
Wow.
Right. So, like, the standard went from, okay, this is a feeder to this is almost exactly like Rebellion.
It's just a premium sort of Australian local show.
Yeah, and I, like, you know, I was charging less for sponsorship and I was charging less for tickets, but I was still putting that card together. And the whole idea of it kind of got diluted and it became a running joke for everyone. It's like, oh, which one are we on? Rebellion or Road to Rebellion? It's like, who are you going to put on it? So I ended up icing that idea for a while. And it was still, like, the standard Rebellion's growing. And the number of, like, pure Muay Thai shows wasn't really there. And that's when we came up with Roots Muay Thai.
Right.
And that's kind of like grassroots roots. Mm-hmm. But also because I've got, like, a weird obsession with reggae.
Yep.
So it's Roots Muay Thai. And each one of them is named after a different Bob Marley song. So the first one was Exodus.
Oh, I love
that. Then one in 2 weeks is One Love. So all the guys, they wear either black shorts or white shorts. And it's got the Rasta colors. And it's got the song name on the back. And we get Jesse I from PBS. He DJs all day. And it's the afternoon show. It's really chilled. It's still Muay Thai, but I like sort of having that, you know, that contradiction of like, everyone's like, oh, it's a fight sport, and you go there and you want to listen to AC/DC, and you come to my show and you're listening to like Bob Marley and Fat Freddy's Drop and Salmonella Dub.
so good.
Yeah. And it's a really cool, nice show. And what we do that in the afternoon, so we do two full pro shows. So everyone's like, oh, Roots an amateur show. It's not. It's still guys who are pro, but they haven't had as many fights. So we start at like 12:30 in the afternoon. We'll put out 13, 14 fights, shut the venue down for an hour, and then we do the big Rebellion pro show at night time.
Right.
That's crazy. I mean, to think the fact that from your second show, you went from having one of Australia's best fighters or second best fighter sitting there as a backup fighter. that's quite an achievement.
Yeah, and it's really funny. Like, the thing with promoting, and this is for jiu-jitsu or anything, professional fighters, if you pay them, they'll fight.
Yep.
Right? And that's not the, that's, you know, anyone can offer a fighter. It's getting it matched up evenly, having a depth of a card. And then for me, it's like some of the guys that will message me or the camps that will message me and go, so-and-so's dying to come out and fight on your show. And I'm like, I'm like a big fan of that dude, right?
Yeah, so you gotta play it cool.
Yeah, like the guy that's my main event on my next show, the number of times I've watched his YouTube videos and kicking pads before I kick pads because
right,
I'm like a fanboy. And then, you know, I get a Facebook message from their camp manager with him holding a pair of Rebellion shirts going, he's dying to come to Melbourne to fight on your show. And then, like, for the last month, I've been getting Instagram messages and stuff of him just like...
So this is these events are obviously, yeah, they're getting a lot of attention on a world stage. So, I mean, what percentage of these fighters on these Rebellion Muay Thai events are international? From the sounds of it, you know, you're talking about Australia's best sitting as a backup to get onto your show.
Yeah. Look, we still predominantly have the cream of the crop Australian, but we'll get usually two or three very good Thai fighters, because at the end of the day, the Thais are still the best at it, especially at the lighter weight classes. I don't like Muay Thai at heavier weight classes. I actually prefer to watch K1 at a 90-kilo fight than Muay Thai. I think Thai boxing, the beauty of the styles, really, like, the lighter guys do it better. But, yeah, we'll get random guys from Scotland, and the guy in my last main event was from Slovakia. Nobody knew him because sometimes fans here only know their best mate. And he came out and he fought Toby Smith, and it was this incredible five-round fight. It was just, who's this guy? And I'm like, well, he's a good dude. He's had a lot of fights.
Who won?
Toby.
Yeah, right.
It's hard to get someone to beat Toby.
Yeah.
Yakub, which is his name, actually, they fought at 76 kilos, but he's 1.96 meters tall. And Toby's Smith's fight style is a clincher near, very aggressive, comes forward. And it was the first time ever, his dad said, since he's been fighting since he was 8 or 9 years old, that somebody outneed him.
Taller.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. Like, Toby clearly won, but it was just insane. Like,
I mean, Muay Thai is like a completely different beast. I mean, from what I understand, I'm not professing to know much about Muay Thai, but you know, you've got this entire almost underground world of Muay Thai fighters that could be, you know, future world champions that people don't even know about. There's so many shows, and there's people who live and breathe the Muay Thai lifestyle in Thailand, for example. And so many of these people are just waiting for their opportunity and just undiscovered gems.
Yeah, and you know, that's, you know, like you'll watch UFC and they always talk about world-class Muay Thai. And those guys are very good strikers for an MMA standard.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, there's the guy, the number 30th ranked guy in Thailand is a million times better than that person. Like, when you see the guys who are up to like 60, 65 kilos, Thais who are top 10 level, it's just something else. And until you're there live watching them, you just go, what the hell is this? Like, what are we doing? I mean, even our Thai trainer, Ton, at the gym, like, he's well and truly retired, but he had 110 fights, 102 wins. He was like Isan champion, which is like Northeast Thailand. And you watch that guy kick and watch the next best Aussie guy you know kick. And it's like, oh, that's a different thing.
Right.
They're just phenomenal. And then Australia's now, like, especially above 67 kilos, producing really good guys. We've got one good kid coming up, 55 kilos, Lockie, who's in Thailand now living. But generally, yeah, there's these random guys in places that are coming up. Thailand's still by far the strongest. But, yeah, there's these random guys that you'll get, like the English guys and the French are phenomenal at it. They're beautiful Muay Thai style. America's surprisingly still quite behind. They've got a couple of guys. But Australia does really sort of well on the world scale, but still not in that stadium Thailand thing. But, yeah, the caliber of guys out there, it's getting high. We've got some guys in Melbourne coming through that you look at them now at five fights. The standard they're fighting now is so much higher than 10 years ago, guys with 50 fights were doing, because they're traveling back and forth. We've got a whole lot of Thai trainers here. Guys are going to those camps, staying there. The Thais are teaching them a bit more. It's not this whole thing where you go there and you're just the
Ferrari. Like,
that's annoying. Yeah, and they just didn't take them. So the knowledge is growing, like every sport, like jiu-jitsu, everything's like the information's out there and it's growing. So the standard's coming up, but still that having, you know, a million people start Muay Thai at the age of seven and, you know, the top 20 guys you get out of that 20 years later is going to be different to a 20-year-old here starting and, you know, the way our hips are and everything from our lifestyles, and they've been kicking and kneeing since they were young.
They've molded their bodies for the art.
Yeah. That's right. And it's culturally, they know it, they understand it. It's like, I'm terrible at Aussie rules football, but I still understand the strategy and stuff. Whereas someone from Korea, it might take them a long time just to even understand the concept of Aussie rules. Same with the Muay Thai guys. They've grown up watching it. It's just a thing. They understand how the scoring works. Everything works. Whereas we're still kind of learning, and we've got our own sort of misconceptions of how it is. And people always go, oh, the Thai style of scoring. It's like, well, there is only one style of scoring. It's Muay Thai. It's Thai style. You're not going to turn around to a Brazilian and go, no. That's not how you get points for Mao. This is how we do it in Australia, right?
Yeah.
So there's that weird thing in Muay Thai. But, it's just the standard. It's just going crazy.
Right. So at least I can speak of, when it comes to jiu-jitsu, I'm seeing year on year new techniques in changing the game, different styles taking shape. Is Muay Thai still something that's sort of evolving in style? Like, for example, are the Australians adding their own sort of angle to it that is presenting new challenges and problems for other international fighters?
Look, the core basics of Muay Thai are always there. But if you watch the way they fought maybe 50 years ago to now, there's definitely a style difference. But still, like, the fundamentals are there. Each region of Thailand will have a sort of a different style that they favor, and you can tell the different camps. So there's different styles of Muay Thai. Like, it gets a bit overused now because of like a couple of videos that go around the net, but there's like the Muay Khao, who are like really aggressive clinches and elbows. There's the Muay Mat, who are more kind of like what we do. They're more punches, low kickers. Then there's the Fimo, who are like the beautiful stylists. They're like the classic stylists. Like, you watch them like Sanchai, you watch them and you go,
yep,
what are you doing, dude? That's like phenomenal. So they've got that. In the Western countries, you'll notice we have more of a culture of boxing. So people like to punch more. And it's always this, like, the argument I always have, people go, oh, yeah, there's more boxing. Westerners have better hands. Thailand's won a lot more gold medals in the Olympics for boxing than we have. They've had a lot more world champions in boxing than we've had. There's a reason why they don't emphasize so much boxing in Muay Thai, and that's the scoring of the sport. And it's like, you can punch, and the guy's blocking, but all of a sudden they knee you. The knee's going to hurt a lot. That's why they knee.
And they use the punches to set up the knees and the kicks.
Exactly that. Yeah. So boxing punches set up punches, Muay Thai punches set up kicks and knees and elbows. And it's a lot more dangerous punching. So the Westerners do tend to do that. And the other thing we tend to do is we start harder from round one. In the stadiums over there, the first two rounds they give, they don't really give much. They basically score it even. They feel each other out, and it's mainly so the gamblers start sussing them out, because it's Muay Thai sort of survives in Thailand because of gambling. Yep. So they do it. Round three and four, they fight their guts out. And then round five, if they know that, if we fought and you know that you've won,
just coast it.
Yeah, you basically put your glove out, I touch it, that means I've conceded, and we dance around for the last 3 minutes, nothing happens, and it's, done.
So what's the reason behind that? Is that to avoid unnecessary punishment? Yeah. Is it a respect thing?
Yeah, well, we're both basically living and training out of a gym.
Right.
Our livelihood depends on fighting, and we're going to fight again, and the decision's kind of been met. There's no point in me getting bashed when you've won, and I've just conceded it. But if I think, no, I can still chin you, I don't have to touch glove. I can still go for it.
Right.
But generally, that's the thing. And it's got its good and bad side. Like, it's happened on my show twice, and other people have gone, oh, I'm like, I saw one of the Aussie guys fought a smaller Thai, and the Thai actually looked comfortable, and the Aussie guy was starting to really hurt him. And round five, they just backed off each other. And everyone was like, this is silly. I'm like, no, I'm really proud of him for doing that.
Yeah.
There's no point hurting him. And one of the guys, local guys, Alexi, he did it to an American guy I had out recently and ended up really hurting him, and he was just punishing him for four rounds. And he was like, clearly he's won. Round five, they backed off each other, and all these people on Facebook saw this. And I'm like, I've got no problem with that. I don't actually need to see someone get absolutely butchered to go, I appreciate this.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, though, we'll start hard from round one until the last round goes. We'll still try and knock guys out.
Do you find that as some sort of a conflict as a promoter, where clearly the fans want to see the two guys beat the shit out of each other, but you actually do have a concern for the welfare of the guys in the ring?
Yeah, it's the culture of the crowd is getting a lot better too. For me, it's a really big struggle because I'm friends with a lot of the Aussie guys, and the guys that I bring from overseas, I'm fans of. So when guys get knocked out, I really struggle with it. I've been in the corner of our own guys when they've knocked guys out, and I celebrate for that a quarter of a second, and then I'm like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
And I was like that when I was younger. My trainer used to say, he said, you look like a psycho until you hurt someone, and then you're like the most remorseful person in the world.
Yeah.
That's a big struggle. For me, I've probably matched 450 fights in the last 6 years, and I probably have had under 20 knockouts.
Right.
So I match them up as evenly as I can. And if a lot of fight sports is guys are getting matched against guys they can build up their records so they get titles and they get their popularity. I just let them fight. If you lose, but you had a good fight, you're still coming back because people appreciate it. Mm. And I just don't want to see one-sided guys, because it is, at the end of the day, it is a dangerous sport.
It's very dangerous, that's right.
You know, and it doesn't take much for people to get hurt, and it doesn't need to happen. I don't want to make money off people getting hurt when I know. If I know you're going to lose, why would I put you in there?
Mm. Yeah. Mm. I mean, talking matchups, I think everyone, every fight fan out there can dream up matchups. You know, you've got things like, you think like McGregor, Mayweather 2 in the octagon, John Jones versus Stipe Miocic, George St. Pierre versus Anderson Silva. Obviously, as a fight promoter and a matchmaker, there's so much more to this. What actually goes into this process that fight fans might not understand?
I get a lot of suggestions on Facebook. Like, people message me all the time, and
my bro's sick. You got to.
My bro's sick. Or how about this guy and that guy? And there's things that stop things happening. Obviously, there's like financial things. There's guys being committed, so you can't do it. But generally, I consider myself a fan of the sport, and I like think about the fights. And I think part of it is it's an art, and it's a feel thing that you can't explain. But part of it is like understanding people's styles. And there's guys that you know that fight a certain way, and if you match them up with somebody else, that it's like lamb to the slaughter. It's not.
Or
all...
you get two conservative fighters jump in, and no one pulls the trigger because they're counter fighters.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not always A beats B beats C, blah, 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 because you can get two, three guys fighting each other and they just get very different results. But that's the main thing, is like their record and seeing who else they fought. So you can just look at two guys' records and go, he's had 20 fights, he's had 20 fights, fight him. But there's one guy who's had 20 fights and he's fought a certain caliber of guys and is a different part of his sort of life. Because, you know, it's like you've got your age and then you've got your fight career age.
Right.
Like strength and condition, like everything. It's like, how long have you been fighting? Because there's a dip point for guys. They've built up their career. Some guys might hit their peak after 15 fights and start dipping off. Some guys are still rising up a lot longer. So, you know, guys will go, oh, that guy's had 70 fights and that guy's had 10 fights. Like, yeah, that's an even matchup. And it's kind of hard sometimes with combat sports board because they go, oh, do you think this is a fair fight? I'm like, what does the other 440 fights I've matched tell you? So there's that. It's, where they're at, their weight, their sort of their fitness level, that sort of how prepared they come in. But generally, nowadays, I know a lot of guys want to get on Rebellion. So if they get the opportunity, they'll show up prepared and put up a good fight. So because they want to come back.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you talk about the fight age, I think of someone like Shogun Hua, who, if you remember the Pride Middleweight Grand Prix, at what, 24 years of age, he'd had so many fights already. And he went through like Quinton Rampage, Jackson, he went through Overeem. And by the time he got to the UFC, you know, we had that. I remember being a, you know, an OG, so to speak, of MMA, if you're getting into Pride. You know, there's always that Pride versus UFC and people saying, oh, you know, Shogun wasn't really that good when he got to the UFC. But it's like the guy had been through so many wars by that time.
Yeah.
Three knee reconstructions.
And that's the most frustrating thing. Everyone's like, you know, Fedor fights in the for Blood, and people are like, Fedor wasn't that good. He was getting monkeys when he was fighting. It's like, okay, cool. You take a footy player who was a Brownlow medalist 10 years ago. Are they playing at that level still now?
Exactly.
No, because Fedor was playing it 10 years ago and he's gone through a lot of stuff and he's off his peak. You can't say he's not as good as... Say the John Wayne Parr Toby thing, there's that thing of, oh, who's the greatest fighter Australia produced? And people go, well, it can't be Wayne Parr because Toby knocked him out.
Yeah. It's like... Toby, reductionist math.
And Toby's 21 and Wayne was 37 and already had 110 fights.
Mm.
Put them both at their peak. You know, I'm not so sure. Like, I love Toby. He's my mate. His dad's my mate. Like John Wayne Parr's an idol, and I'd be like, still, you know, probably Parr. It's hard to tell. Like, you can't do it. It's like Muhammad Ali or Mike Tyson. It's like, well, it's not a fair comparison.
And the reality is when you hit the top of the game at that age, everyone is actually focusing on you and training to beat you. You're the style. You're the guy to beat. So, you know, when you're at the top, you know, you're not fixating on one person to beat. You're just trying to retain.
Yeah, but and think about, you know, you go into jiu-jitsu school and you're a white belt. And there's that purple belt that you couldn't even get close to. 5 years later, you're a lot closer to him.
Absolutely.
And you're a lot closer to your black belt instructor. The level hasn't just, that gap hasn't maintained itself.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that sort of learning curve. So there's a lot of things I think fight fans don't think. And it's, you know, like for me, it's almost like politics. I had to stop watching Fox News because it used to piss me off so much. So yeah. I've had to kind of like avoid fight forums and things a lot because I'm just like... The promoter thinks it's great, talk shit, build up fights, and then, like, even at the last show when Yakub came to fight, there was a French guy that was going to come to fight. Everyone bagged him out, and he ended up getting injured. He couldn't get here. I actually messaged a guy. I'm so sorry. Some of the Aussie fans don't even know who you are.
Mm.
And then this other guy, everyone's like, oh, he doesn't look like much. And it's like, look, it's great that you've got that opinion, but you've got, what's that opinion based on? You haven't looked into it. All right. Like, by the end of the night, I was so charged. I was running around yelling at people in the crowd that I knew had said stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, it's been, probably isn't that professional. I'm like, what would I know about matchmaking? You know better.
You're like me now, but
it was kind of like that. It was just, you know, when you talk about the matchmaking thing, like I said before, Toby's a clinch fighter. So this French guy, he puts up a video of him hitting pads and he keeps dropping his hands and he's kicking the pad and I was like, oh, his hands are pretty low and he's, you know.
People used to say that about Krokop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then I kind of sat there for a while and I'm like, I don't want to engage him. And then finally I said, look, Toby beats everyone by knees and elbows. He's never dropped, like as far as I remember, he hasn't dropped people with hands in the last 5-10 years.
Mm.
This guy, they call him Dr. Knees. He won his first 25 fights by knee stoppage.
Wow.
And he's over 1.90 meters tall.
Mm.
There's a reason I've matched it, but they just don't get it. So, like, you go, you sit there, you take it. And sometimes you've had a long day and you go, all right, let's play.
Makes me think of, was it Sammy Schilt, I think, was he basically throws knees like jabs.
Yeah, and he had that teep and he front kick, and he used to almost like toe poke it instead of a ball thing, and he used to knee, and he's, it's like, we've got a guy, the guy in my main event next show, his the first time he fought on my show, he was at 65 kilos. And I'm like, he keeps sending me photos for the posters, George Mann. And I kept sending it back, going, man, I can't put these on the posters. He looks like an English schoolboy who hasn't quite got on the rowing team yet, so his body hasn't filled out. Comes out, and I know he's a good fighter, but he comes out, and I'm like, dude, how tall are you? It's like 6'4". 6'4" at 65 kilos.
Wow.
And yeah, man, like, shit. And perfectly uses his body, same thing, uses his front kick and knees and just distance and beautiful. And it is, you look at their body and it's like, it's made for that style. Now, you can come up with a matchup for him that you'd go, oh yeah, that guy will smash him. Look at him, he looks like a beanpole. It's like, George will do the job, trust me.
Yeah. I mean, range is a very important thing. I mean, obviously, you know, sometimes you get these exceptional, talented fighters that come through. I mean, I imagine that sometimes they're just really difficult to work with. How do you manage that as a promoter? I mean,
had any prima donnas?
Yeah, not in Muay Thai, not a lot. And the guys you get that are like that, it's the bizarrest thing. And I don't want to blame the MMA culture, but it tends to be the guys who've had two fights, maybe one. They've got their own athlete page on Facebook, and they've got seven sponsors, and the sponsors probably give them like 5% off online purchases. Mm, and they've got this thing, and they show up, and there's those guys. But I like don't really deal with them. Once you're difficult once, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, absolutely.
The good guys, the really good guys in Muay Thai, that's the one hard thing about them. The best guys in Muay Thai, almost 100% of them are the ones that are worst at promoting themselves. Like Toby Wayne's post stuff on Instagram, or like he'll be fighting. Like if he pushed out your live stream details, you'd probably end up selling an extra 300-400 there. He just doesn't do it. Like his greatest interview that I always bring up, and I was giving him shit about recently, was he fought in an 8-man 3-4 years ago in Queensland, and he's in the final, and Mark Hammer's interviewing him, and before the final it's like he does this big thing, you know, Toby, big 8-man, you've beat some of the best guys, you're only 18 years old, you know, tournaments are different, each opponent's different, have you prepared for this? And literally this is like on Fox, they're live, he goes, I've done Muay Thai. Because to him it was like, what have you done to prepare for this? I did Muay Thai. Yeah. And he just has no self promotion. And then last week we went and interviewed one of the girls who's had like 10 fights, and just the interview was like, if you were going to write a script for someone to promote Muay Thai and your event, that's how you'd write it. And she's just perfectly well spoken, exactly knew what to say. And then some of the other guys, just they're just fighters. And it's fine because they promote your event in a completely different way.
Mm-hmm.
So Toby's 18 then. How old is he now? And you're
23, 24.
And he's an absolute superstar in Muay Thai already.
Yeah, Toby the Weapon Smith. So it's gone a little bit hard because, like I said, the sort of weight classes, once it gets to about 72 kilos, really the talent starts to dry up.
Right.
He's a super middleweight, which is 76.
And he's growing.
Possibly. Yeah, hopefully not much more.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's definitely going to get too hard.
Yeah.
So now the main guys that are competitive opponents for him, they also cross over with fighting in like organizations like Glory and stuff, who've probably got a little bit more money. I mean, they're still, it's not a huge pay what they get, but it's getting harder and harder, and they've got contracts and stuff. So it's getting harder to match him. So I've got him on my August show again. So I've been talking to a couple of French guys who are like, big, tall, strong clinches.
Right.
Because the ties at that weight, they're not, it's not a good weight for them anymore.
Right. So how often are you running these, you know, Rebellion shows?
Four times a year. So March, May, August, November. And every day we do two shows. And we did one in Sydney in 2016. And there's always this plan to do another one, but I come up with other things I want to do at the same time. So
that's each event is Roots and then Rebellion on the same day.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
So good.
Yeah, it's challenging because we get into a venue that's basically a shell at 7 a.m. and then we leave at 3 a.m. the next day. And this whole thing happens in between. And like the guys who help out on the day and the day before at the weigh-in, they're like legends, my mates from the gym and stuff. But yeah, you get to Monday and it's like,
So why do you run two shows on the same day? You've got the Roots, then the Rebellion Muay Thai.
Yeah, so the Roots one, there's a lot of gyms, newer gyms in Melbourne that wouldn't be able to have fighters on Rebellion.
Right.
And I kind of find Roots as a good sort of like crossover thing for them to get in, see how we run the show, how professional we are with it, how the scoring, like, because we use Thai judges and stuff, how that works. And then the, you know, like, the fans, if you buy tickets to one, you get to come to the other one. So,
right.
So their fans, I might be a fan of my mate who's, you know, only had one fight. I'll come and watch him fight, but then I'll stay back and watch the high end guys and then really fall in love with Muay Thai. So I'm trying to bring new fighters and new fans and new gyms into it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so far, it's working well. And it's just helping develop relationships with a few. And so a lot of guys will fly themselves from like Perth and Queensland and stuff, because normally we pay and fly fighters over.
Yep.
But for the route shows, a lot of people from interstate will make their own way down just to fight on it. So as an opportunity to get on.
Amazing. I mean, so as a jiu-jitsu guy, for me, Boa 8 is like the Olympics for jiu-jitsu.
Oh, yeah.
Happens every 2 years, it seems. I'm glad we don't have to wait 4 years. And we're fast.
You almost had to. It was just almost 3 years, so it was getting late.
I mean, so we're approaching the fourth edition of Boa 8, yet another star-studded event of local and international superstars. You know, on the previous editions, we had Roberto, Satoshi, Souza. I mean, I still, every now and then when I show people jiu-jitsu and cool fighters, I show him, and I particularly show that Dragon Ball Z entrance, yeah, which is just crazy. You know, you had guys like Marcus Souza, the lightweight tournament winner, Leon Neto, Lachlan Giles, Edward Najmi, so many more to name. And as always, you know, you've always got some big news for these shows. So let's start with how did Boa 8 begin? For the uninitiated, what's it about? How did it begin?
So obviously started promoting Muay Thai, and I like all fight sports. Like, it's this weird thing in a show, everyone calls me Mr. Muay Thai, and like, I get guys that are like my Muay Thai heroes calling me, and I'm like, this is so embarrassing. Like, you're Mr. Muay Thai, please don't do that.
Yeah.
But I love all fight sports. Like, you know, I joke about Enter the Dragon, but like the whole Mr. Han having the island and bringing all the fighters in, mm-hmm, and Kumite and Bloodsport, I love that stuff, right?
And that was like a really sort of early MMA, actually.
Yeah, that armbar, Bruce Lee.
Yeah, the opening thing. So years ago, when I just started promoting, you know, friends of ours, Charles and Ryan, so I started talking about pro jiu-jitsu, and I think it was around that time Metamora started,
mm-hmm,
but they were doing single matchups. And then a little while later, I did my tournaments for Rebellion, which I do my 8-man every year, and I was like, this will be cool to do. And I was talking for ages. Like, it was this thing running around in the back of my head. I wanted to do it. And I like running events. I like fight sports, and I like running the events, and I get like a creative outlet, because I'm not good at drawing or anything like that. So it's this thing I do.
Yeah. Yeah, bringing a vision to life.
Yeah. And the second Road to Rebellion, I think I ran, Tiago came to watch, and he walked in and he goes, man, this is huge. And I'm like, I want to do this with jiu-jitsu. And he's like, you know, Tiago was like super pumped about it.
I gotta say, these events are spectacles. They're ridiculous.
Yeah, it was good. And so
just to be clear, that's Tiago Stefanuti.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolute.
Yeah. And Tiago was teaching at my old gym, Kaizen Fitness, Tiago and Gustavo and those guys. And then we caught up and I said, look, this is kind of what I want to do. What do you think about the rule sets, about dates, who we can get? And then the first one, just the response was ridiculous. And I had an idea of what I wanted the event to look like. And, you know, with Muay Thai and boxing, it's quite regulated by combat sport and international rules. Boa, like, you know, the first Boa.
We were there, man.
So, yeah, at Malvern. And the day before, on the Friday, we started putting the staging together. And the guy who was doing my staging calls...
Like a pit of death.
Right? So
it's literally what it looked like.
Yeah.
If you weren't there, I don't think you can truly understand that it was like an elevated stage where, you know, when people dream about like ultimate arenas, I think the only thing missing from it was like a moat of crocodiles swimming around it. If you get out of the stage, you get eaten alive.
And this is like, so I've gone, okay, I don't want to do, everyone's like, put it in a boxing ring. I'm like, I was like, I want this thing. So I was like, okay, we're going to build staging, do this. And I found a staging guy, and he's like, okay, you can do the stages at 6 centimeters, 1.2, blah, blah, blah. I'm like...
So was this, were these like the health and safety requirements or...?
No. This is the problem with it. That who's got health and safety requirements? So he comes in on the day to set it up. He goes, oh, I just came out from this other gig, so we've got the legs for the stage. Because I was going to go 60 centimeters off the ground. I can go up to 120. And I've got zero concept of height and distance, right?
Yeah,
even though, like, another friend of ours, Jared, reckons I can pick everybody's height by just looking at them. So I'm like, yeah, we'll do 1.2. And I dock out. This is at Malvern Town Hall to get coffee. Come back, and they've put the first few stages up. And I've looked up, and I'm like...
And it's not even finished.
Yeah, and it's high, right? So he builds it out, and we build the ramp to the main stage, and then we built out all the seating, and then I was like, I need 9 rows of seats here. So he ends up building this seating all the way up to the balcony at Malvern, and it's built out, right? And I was just watching, and I walked out again, went for a walk down, is it High Street? And I messaged one of my mates. I'm like, there should have been an adult here. Because this is... ludicrous. It's this. I think it was 8 meter by 8 meter or 6 meter by 6 meter mat, and it's a meter and 20 centimeters off the floor. There's nothing around it.
I remember thinking this might be the first and the last bowler.
Yeah, and then I've kind of gone, all right, who's coming to help tomorrow? Because I've got all these volunteer crew at the gym, and I'm like, they didn't even probably work out. I'll just get a bunch of guys, they sit around the thing. If it looks
just,
like...
Just hold people in place.
Exactly. If it looks like they're going to fall off...
It's kind of like Pride, where people are being thrown out of the ring. Just push them back in.
Exactly. And, I think there was all this... When we put the tickets online, people were going, what? Like, pay $60 to come and watch a jiu-jitsu show?
They don't understand.
And then they walked in, and it was like... Yep. There's like lights and music.
It's theatrical.
And DJ.
I get it now. Yeah.
Breakdancing.
And
the drummers and everything.
So, yeah, the first one, and then one of my Muay Thai friends showed up and goes, does combat sports board regulate this? I'm like, no. He's like, who regulates this? I'm like, me, I guess. And, so the first one was really good. And it was funny. I always remember that when the main event was Will Diaz and Bruno Alves.
Yeah.
And I've, like, my worst memories of jiu-jitsu tournaments is being there where there's a hold up for 10 minutes where guys are screaming and arguing about the decision and undoing their belt. And I was like... And I remember the final happened, and it was all that controversy.
Yeah.
I mean, it was earlier when Kid and Bruno fought about the restart.
Yeah, and the restarted pretty much in an omoplata with a choke on.
Yeah. Fuck.
Yeah.
And again, guys are running to me going, you got to change this. I'm like, you know, I'm the world's longest running white belt. I'm not going to walk up and go, yeah, you know what, that rule wasn't right.
For some reason, I had this idea in my head that you were the longest serving blue belt, but I think you might mind the longest serving white belt record.
Yeah, I've gone up to like 23 years. I've kept going up to like just before blue, and then I stop again. And I remember standing there, and is it Graham Johnson, that was Kapo Puku?
Yes.
His brother was there at one of the tables, and the judge the ring. And he's just, I'm standing there holding the belt, and he's just screaming, rah! And I'm looking at him, I'm like, what do you want me to do? I'm not the judges. And then I look over to Tiago, and Tiago is just like, it's like, because I talked about how much I hated the arguing.
Yeah.
And then the thing was done, and he goes, I was just sitting there going, he's going, I'm never fucking doing this again. And then we did it, and then, you know, the reaction was so massive, and then, 3 months later was number two, and I brought the stage down a little, because I think Marco Souza in the first one, he cartwheeled off the side, and he landed on his feet and jumped straight back up.
I remember.
And I was like, yeah, look, maybe
he's an athletic guy. He's pretty acrobatic. He'll be fine.
Yeah. And the second one, we lowered it, but... Setting up that whole space was so much work. Like, me and a few of the guys from the gym were getting in there early in the morning, like 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. I got these like girls from the gym dressed up underneath these stages, taking them apart because we had to get stuff out because you can't have the place for 2 nights. And like so many of those guys.
So this was like preparing the stage just to assess if it's viable and then.
No, taking it down after the event.
Oh, sorry, after the event.
Yeah. Setting it up and taking it down is like. There's so much that goes on with running an event that people don't see from getting things like even a liquor license and getting tickets printed to security approved to light and sound and this, but like something like building staging is just so time consuming. And then the third one, I was like, I need a venue that's set up. So the third one we did, and I always wanted to do something at a theater. So the third one we did at the National Theatre in St Kilda, and we did the whole curtain raise. But the atmosphere wasn't the same having it on one side. Like, it wasn't the same for the athletes. Some of them liked it. It wasn't the same for the athletes. It wasn't the same for the fans. And for me, because I get like my charge of people, and I'm like, yeah, this is cool, I'll do this again. We were like literally...
It's just too far removed.
Yeah, well, we're behind in the back of house. So we're not interacting with people. To go out there, we had to basically exit the venue, go on Barclay Street. It was really... You didn't know what was happening and people were reacting, and I found it really weird. Like, there was elements of it I loved. Like, you know, I'm a fight sports guy running gyms and stuff, but I'm doing something at like this iconic theater and like the photos and stuff, like they came out so beautifully. I was like, yeah, we'll do a curtain raise here and then we'll drop the curtain here and we'll do this. It's like, yeah. But yeah, that one was, it didn't have the energy at all that I wanted. And there was just stuff happening on the night and the lead up that I just kind of went, this is just, I don't want to do this anymore. And I was like, rebellion was growing and stuff. So it just went, and everyone was like, come on, man, come on, man, come on, man. Everyone was like messaging me. All the time.
When's the next boa?
Yeah, and I'm like, the guys, Grant and Scott from Fight Factory, like, they were supporters from day one. And, like, I even went and caught up with them. They're like, when are you going to do the next one? I think the last one was in September, and I was like, I'll do it in July. And then, like, a whole year went past, and another year went past, and everyone's, like, messaging and tagging photos and stuff. And occasionally I go on the page and answer a question and put up a photo just to keep
just
it going.
Just to keep it alive.
Yeah. But at the same time, all along, as I'm doing Rebellion, and then I have this thing where I want to do this big three-day fight festival of all these different martial arts and stuff. And it was like, and the guy, a couple of the guys that were involved with production, like filming and stuff, were like, this is the best combat sports event we've been to. They're like, Rebellion's amazing. Everyone knows it. But this is just this unique thing, just... the event being in there, and that's essentially what I want. I want people to walk in and just go, holy fuck, and walk out and then be like, I'm going to go do Muay Thai now. I'm going to go to Jiu-Jitsu now. They got like an aspirational thing to do. Yeah, I think we sort of achieved it with that. But yeah, it just kind of went off for 3 years.
Yeah, so... Thank you for returning to it. So what's happening with this next edition? You know, what's it about? What are we going to see?
So we're going to see a few extra things, and it's sort of the more days go by, the more things kind of come up.
Yep.
So I didn't want to come back and do it again and be what it was last time because 3 years has gone by, a lot of other pro shows have come by. And there's guys who are loyal to it who'll come back, and I don't want them to come back and go, oh, this isn't as good as I thought it was. I want them to come back and go, oh, this is just something else.
Yeah.
And also doing it, like, it has to have that sort of payoff for me of this is spectacular. So few things differently. Obviously, the biggest thing was the first event. Was not the biggest thing. One of the main things was the first few, we had sort of our own limited rule sets. It was IBJJF rules with... just a couple of alterations. And now it's going to be ADCC rules. It was a gi event with some no-gi super fights. This is no-gi ADCC.
All no-gi.
Yeah.
All the exciting leg locks, everything that all the fans want to
see. Yeah. And it's, you know, like, I don't like the idea of a fight sport having too many different rule sets, but I think the ADCC rule set is, it's established. It's not like something someone just came up with. And everyone always goes, oh, do a sub-only thing. And I'm like, that kind of creates too many issues in a tournament format and biases and this and that.
Yeah, and how do you determine a winner?
Exactly. So that's one of the main things. The other thing is the first event, the first three events, the prize money was $5,000. It's $20,000 now. So
that's crazy. $20,000 for a jiu-jitsu event. I mean,
first place, you get it and you walk away with it.
I can't even think of I mean, apart from Abu Dhabi, they aren't really paying that much. And, you know, pro jiu-jitsu events are really only in the last few years. I mean, when the first boa came out, it was like boa, I couldn't really think of many other events. Now you've got a few other sort of smaller shows, but $20,000 for a first place winner is incredible.
Yeah, and I mean, like, one of the things I always tell people is, like, I remember seeing a video on Satoshi. And they went to his house and he had the check on the wall and the belt.
Oh.
And even at the thing, he was going, man, this belt is so heavy, I love it.
Yeah.
And then I went the next day to give him his money. And he's like, I slept with this belt last night. Oh. Like, fuck. He's just like, this is something that, you know, we made that's so important to you. But, yeah, I kind of looked around and I'm like, I don't know if there's any events where it's an 8-man, not a 16 or something. You don't have to go through all these qualifiers. That's that sort of prize money. So I wanted to come in with a bang and go, this is the prize money. And the other thing is it's predominantly going to be overseas fighters. I want people to see people that they've only... What I've tried to do with Rebellion, I wanted to do here is like people that you dreamt of seeing to come and see. Which, you know, going back on the Facebook thing, like, I've put up on Facebook so many times, oh, who do you want to see? And the guys from Melbourne that have
been
tagged...
I'm embarrassed. I've even been tagged in this.
I'm embarrassed for you.
Thank you.
No, but I'm like, oh, I beat Brenton in an 8-man once. No.
As a white belt. Yeah, no, it wasn't even an 8-man. It was just a...
King of
a
the mountain.
It was like a white belt, just terrible matchup. It was,
and a Peruvian necktie. It doesn't matter.
You still remember it?
Oh, yeah. It's the one time I've ever pulled that off. I'd seen it like a day before on TV or something.
Thank you.
Anyway, don't worry. You took me down, though.
You built a career off me. I appreciate it.
That's my main claim to fame. It's on my resume. But anyway, so I put it up, and then, like, I've had people, you know, like, Burak's been tagged 800 times, and I like Burak. And people message me, like, inbox me, and put videos. Like, look... And I'm like, okay, well, I'm putting up this prize money. I'm willing to fly people out. Do you really want to see six guys from Melbourne fighting this? Because you could go to the Pampax and do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So that's been a bit challenging with it. But the six guys, non-Australians that are in, the one that was obvious at 88 kilos was Craig. So he was always going to be in.
Very interesting timing considering that a local grown talent such as Craig has just had one of the most phenomenal years of jiu-jitsu in any jiu-jitsu fighter.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. See, it just, like, the weight class is sort of the same weight class we did for the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think
you're 88 kilos.
Yeah. And the Craig thing happened and... that all kind of gelled well into together.
It's funny you bring up Burak and Craig because I think Craig's only fought, both Craig and Burak have fought on Boa, and Burak actually beat Craig a few years ago.
Yeah, the first one.
Very different fighters now.
Yeah.
Both amazing.
Yeah. And it's, so Craig came on and then we started putting the information out and it became this like running joke from me. Like, I had these guys like, Philippe Penna and stuff like messaging me and I'm like, this is fucking sweet.
Oh, man.
And then we have the conversation of, so you got a contract with ACB, right? And they're like, yeah, and they can't compete on it. So and the level of guys I've had, and they're like, it can, if it's an open and anyone can enter it, we can come. If it's an invitational, we can't come.
So can you then have a tournament that allows them to qualify for it and enter?
Yeah, well, you can do that. And the other idea I had was to do an elite open. So have novice, intermediate, advanced during the day and then have an elite open. But the elite open requirements is that you've placed in the top two in the world at an event, which would narrow them down. But I'm like, you know, I'm not really going to mess with the Chechenian guys and their rules. But it just became this running thing. I had so many guys, and they're like, I was going to get Jackson Souza.
I was even talking to Keenan Cornelius.
We've talked about it a couple of times.
Yeah, trying to say, how can we actually mastermind this to get some of these fan favourites on?
Yeah, and it was, it got to that point, and it was like, and yeah, I think like Jackson Souza was talking to him, and he goes, oh, I'm going to sign this contract. I've got to check it. I was like, I'll tell you what's in it now. You can't do it. So, but then the guys that we did end up with, I think it's a pretty cool lineup. Mm-hmm. So, obviously, Craig's on, Charles Negromonte's on, DJ Jackson's on, Gilbert Burns.
Current UFC fighter, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu world champion.
Yep. Philippe Pomaski, Michael Perez.
James Brasco.
Yeah. And he's a funny one, man. Like, he started Instagram messaging me straight away.
Yeah.
And I was like, this guy's a dick. Like, there was stuff he was saying. And then now, like, I'm like, this is the coolest dude I've ever, like, I'm actually looking forward to meeting him. Because, like, A, like, he's funny as hell. And B, like, on Facebook, now I've got him as a Facebook friend. He's like, his politics and stuff's really cool. Like, even the other day, he's like, oh, you know, come June, I'm going to come all guns blazing. I'm like, in Americans and your guns. He goes, I hate guns. There's no point for guns. I'm like, hey,
can't bring that AR over here.
No, I'm like, you're a cool dude. So we've got the seven. as an eighth spot, and then there's all these guys in Melbourne that put me in as the eighth spot, and everyone's like, I'll just message you and you'll just do it, right? Because, like, we're mates. And I'm like, well, there's a few guys that make a good point for this. And so May 26th, 2 weeks after the next rebellion, we're going to do the Bawa Challenger Series.
Right.
Because I haven't got enough stuff to do. So we're going to do a tournament to qualify for the final spot. I just went, like, I've been waiting on this venue to get back to me, and they didn't. And then when I booked another venue, and then they got back to me because they're awesome. But we've got a, I've got a really cool venue in Moorabbin that's it's like a American barbecue place, smokehouse, and in the back of it they've got this car park / function area.
What's it called? What's the place called?
Big Big Little Pig, but the warehouse is called Warehouse 35.
Right.
So
at an undisclosed location.
Yeah, yeah. So the feel of it's going to be a little bit different. DJ and all that, and have the event run, and I'm gonna put up $2,000 for the winner of that, so they get the money and they get to go into the main eight man. And now, you know, you might have a suggestion, because it's going to be a, it's a nighttime event. We might put up some super fights, just guys who want to have a little match with each other, and might do a little maybe like a brown belt tournament or something as well at a different weight class, or a black belt tournament. Just feel like it'll, we're there, we've got the mat, we've got the venue, we want people to come and watch it. So the Challenger Series, May 26th, then Bawa Open June 23rd, Bawa Super 8 June 23rd, and then Bawa Open during the day, which is just a straight gi and no gi tournament, with the addition that the finals of the black belt divisions will be the opening fights of the Bawa Super 8 at night. So if you go into the black belt divisions and you make the final, you come back at night and you compete at Bawa Super 8 on flow grappling in front of everyone.
Wow. Yeah. Flow grappling, that's obviously massive. So flow grappling being sort of the premier broadcasting network for jiu-jitsu and grappling in general. Yeah. How did that come about?
They contacted me after the last event, and I said, look, I don't know when the next one's going to be. And then when this one started to gain momentum, I sent a message, but I could see that it wasn't seen. Like, I sent it to one of the guys' private message, and I could see, you know, I hadn't even looked at it. And then he messaged me through the Bawa page, and I'm like, check your inbox. And then we started talking. And I was planning on doing Bawa sort of towards the end of last year, but getting the venue and all that stuff was getting a little bit crazy, so it kind of just got pushed back and pushed back, and I thought, man, people are going to go, this guy's just stringing us along. And then finally I kind of got my brain around how to do this. So yeah, and yeah, it's great, like, you know, being on flow grappling, it'll be good exposure for the event, obviously, good exposure for the Australian scene, because there'll be obviously super fights and stuff. Hopefully, as we get sponsors and stuff on board, it'll be good exposure for them. I guess the main thing is, hopefully, like, people don't just decide to sit at home and watch it on flow.
Yeah.
If we don't have a live audience, it won't happen again. So.
No, I'm there. I've booked my VIP table. I'm there front center.
Yeah, good.
I tell you what I'm learning from this is that, literally, like that Kevin Costner movie, you know, if you build it, they will come.
Yeah. And they do, and it's like, you know, like everyone, you do stuff and you get so much self-doubt. It's like, what if I do this? And then, like, and then it's like, nah, people come. And even, I think, Bawa will be my, so what have I done? 18 rebellions, 6 road to rebellions, 6. So I've done 30 shows plus the 3 boys. I've done 33. By the time this one comes up, it'll be like number 37 in 6 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm still going, do people still want to come to this? It's like your birthday party when you're a kid all over again, going, are they going to show up?
Yeah.
So I think they are.
Absolutely. I mean, as I said, these are just spectacles. They're very different. I mean, so many people say, oh, you know, I don't want to come see a jiu-jitsu event. And BSA, what you're actually comparing to is an 8-hour tournament with IBJJF, where people's fights aren't running on time. You know, you're waiting 2 hours for your friend to fight. Maybe it's a 5-minute fight and that's it and it's over. I mean, these are actually perfectly constructed events.
Spectator events.
Yeah. Yeah, incredible. So $20,000 for the total winner. You know, as far as these fighters, you know, what else can we sort of expect from the show?
So there'll be Like I said, the black belts will be competing at the start of the night.
Is that going to be gi or no gi?
Gi and no gi.
Gi and no gi. Yeah. So there's going to be a qualifier tournament during the day.
Yeah. So we've got a very big venue. It's the size of 4 basketball courts.
Wow.
So when you come in, there'll be a sectioned off area that you won't see. Will be the bowl arena that we're building during the day. So it'll be open for the event at night. There'll be a food and entertainment area, and then the 6 mats for the comp. That'll go on all during the day. And then at nighttime, 6:30, the arena opens for ticket holders and stuff, and the mat set up and everything that you sort of kind of half expect. So the black belts, their final matches they'll have at the opening of that, and then we'll have super fights and the tournament.
Incredible, incredible.
Yeah.
So with some of these superstar names you've gotten, are all these fighters dudes approaching you, or have you got someone you're working with that's like a talent scout?
No, so Tiago did pretty much all of the matchmaking of the last ones. This one, I approached some, and a few approached me. I had a couple of guys help in research. I did some of my own research of the weights and who's coming up. Because obviously, like I said, some of them have, some of the main guys have contractual obligations where they can't come in.
Mm.
So some of those guys were off the menu for now. Mm-hmm. And I think those things will open up again in a couple of years.
Yep.
But some of the guys, basically, a couple of the guys I thought, who are the guys who are going to be like, it's such a cheesy thing to say, but like the next Craig Jones, who are about to just go blow up. Because for the show, like, we want high-level competitors, but we want guys who are popular and high-level competitors. It's got to be a good balancing.
And how do you balance that? I mean, obviously, you've got you've got fighters that are incredibly talented, but they don't always yield an entertaining watch. I mean, you can think of countless champions who... Plenty of people always bring up Georges St-Pierre. It was amazing to watch once he got his belt. He was a lot more conservative, and it was more about just, not losing and retaining that belt. Mm. So as a matchmaker, how do you actually go about ensuring you get that healthy balance of talent and entertainment?
I think some of it is luck, and I don't think you can ever... for it to be a sport, I don't think you can ever dismiss someone because they're boring.
Mm.
And I get this a lot with guys messaging me, especially about bar, going, I'm going to put on a big show.
Mm.
I'm like, look, you can say you're going to put on a big show and you're going to be entertaining, win, lose, or draw, but if you get submitted in the first 30 seconds, you're not putting on a show.
Yeah.
So you've got to be good at what you do first. And then a lot of the other stuff is like, it's really basic but dumb stuff, but it's easy to do these days is... researching the Instagram and Facebook profile pages and reading their profiles online and watching their fights and just seeing it, like, because all that stuff's accessible. And any of this stuff, like, you just got to do it and practice and go through the timeline. And, I had a guy do some research for me, come up with all the top guys that we could look at. Then I started looking more, so I wasn't just sitting there going through 1,000 names. So I got given a list. Shortlisted for me.
Yeah.
I went through that. Once the flow grappling thing came up, a few people got tagged. They approached me, and then I sort of sussed them out and kind of got a vibe thing off them. And I asked people, obviously. I've messaged you a few times. I've spoken to Craig a few times, and I was like, hey, man, dude, who's actually going to give you a hard fight?
And did he probably name me to sort of like people like me so we can get his $20,000?
Yeah, and... you meet some guys and you go, there's guys who'll go, yeah, I just want to get the easiest fights to get my $20,000. Yeah. And then I've found
that the last... name 7 white belts.
Yeah.
At once.
Yeah. And it's like, you over time, I think, even though they're different sports, I've realized the guys who want to be in it because they want the challenge, and the guys who want to be in it just to win the money. And the guys who want to be in it for the challenge... the money helps, they're the ones we want. Like, they're guys who, like, I don't think Craig wants to be part of something that is going to be a walkover for him.
Yeah.
And he said, like, he'll message me and goes, man, I can't believe some of the guys you got. It's really good, big exposure. And I think most people want Australian jiu-jitsu to get on the world scene even bigger.
Yeah, absolutely.
So everyone's kind of rooting for it that way. There is always selfish people who'll say other stuff, but that's essentially like I've had feedback from him. Mille from Peter De Beans, he trains boxing with me. I bounce ideas off him. I've got friends who are like, you know, Rob McKenzie and those guys who are like jiu-jitsu fans more than practitioners these days, but they know the names more than I do because I'm trying to stay on top of like Muay Thai and boxing and jiu-jitsu and all this stuff. So I get their opinion too. But I think the depth of it's really good. The challenging next part's going to be getting the super fights. I'm in negotiations with a couple of people.
So is there a few other big names, international names, that could be arriving on this card?
Yeah.
As far as the super fights?
Yeah, yeah. There's one that I really... Like, he's been in, I guess, sort of the grappling world news a lot lately, so I'm trying to work him out to get out of here. Don't guess, because it's then if I can't do it, it's bad for all of us. But, yeah, so I'm trying to do that, and part of it is, like, you know... It's the response to the show so far gauges how deep I want to go in with bringing in big names and paying them big dollars is, you know.
Yeah, I mean, how do you actually work that out? I mean, obviously, I'm not asking for business secrets here, but, you know...
You're the wrong person if you are.
Oh, look, I don't know. These are incredible shows. You know, you think of fantasy-based matchups. You know, the UFC obviously undoubtedly stirs quite a lot of controversy with some of its matchups and its preferential treatment of celebrities. But at the end of the day, it's an entertainment industry, and that is what makes it financially viable and actually, you know, feasible. You know, people have got to buy the pay-per-views, they've got to buy the tickets, you need sponsors, all of that. It needs to be financially endeavour to be viable. So how do you actually sort of manage that and being able to put on a good show?
Yeah, I'm not being, like, modest. I do that quite... That's probably my weakest point. Mm-hmm. I sort of... spend first and then kind of figure out how it's all going to come back.
Yeah.
And a few of my Muay Thai shows, I've lost the amount of money I've lost running them. It's like, if I tell people, they're like, holy shit.
Yeah,
but I kind of back myself that I'm like, yeah, this one was bad, the next one I'll sort it out. And the other scary thing my accountant hates is I keep 99% of stuff in my head. So I budget in my head, I do stuff, and then I write it down like a week out, and I'm like, sweet. Like, even my Rebellion cards, I've matched 27 fights for a show in 2 weeks' time. I basically only started writing it down on a spreadsheet like a week ago, just so I could give it to Combat Sports. So I keep a lot of that stuff in my head. I think I've got a pretty good feel for a lot of it. But yeah, you've got to balance that, because there's stuff that you want to go and it's happening with some of the pro shows now. It's happened with Muay Thai in the past. Big chunks of money come in, and it makes it harder for people like me, because I can tell you where all my money comes from, and I don't have a lot of sponsors and stuff. I basically do it off ticket sales. But those shows come in, and they're a bump, but there's only so much money coming into the sport for how much people are spending on it. So a lot of those shows, they put in a lot, and then the money's not coming back, so they disappear again, and they leave a void again. But I try to be just consistently with that, not be stupid, and be smart the way we spend the money and the budget.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So something else you brought up, and I find this obviously frustrating as a fan, and I imagine as a matchmaker and promoter, it has to absolutely kill you. You talked about fighters being locked into contracts. I mean, what's your view on that? Is that something that's hurtful? Is it beneficial at the end of the day for a fighter?
I think it makes perfect sense that the contracts exist. So there's a guy that I use, Tom Gathagol, who makes incredible videos for me. And he's done it as a freelancer previously, and now he's a full-time employee for my promotions company. It's called Outliers Promotions,
right,
and my two gyms. So we go and make, like, interviews and profile pieces on fighters, and we spend... You know, we've gone to gyms for like 3-4 hours and filmed, and he spends a whole week editing it, and we build up this fighter, right? And they've got no contractual tie to me, so I build them up, and they fight on Rebellion, they
get
the
fighters,
they do, but I've got no guarantee that's ever going to come back to me, right? Because tomorrow they can, and it's happening to me now, as guys that I built up through Rebellion fighting on another show on the same night as me. And it's like, it's not I don't want to use the loyalty thing, because I guess, but there's no obligation to do anything that way. And it's happened the reverse way too, where guys have built their name somewhere else and then they've gone, oh, I want to be on Rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
So it happens, but contractually it makes sense. And people can say whatever they want about the UFC, but at the end of the day, if they didn't run that business the way they do it and Dana wasn't the guy that was it, we'd still be watching dodgy VHS tapes from Sydney, right?
Yep.
And those things need to exist. For me, I struggle to say to someone, you're tied into me and now you owe me this.
And when, so, especially when it's their career.
And it's their career. And you, like, you can contract someone. I could contract the guy and say you can only fight on BOA. I'm going to do 2 BOAs a year. Mm. I'm not going to tell a guy he can't make a living. Same with Muay Thai, especially with Muay Thai. Like, the money's not that grand in it, and it's like I can't say, just fight for me.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I can't get in matchups. So there's things I want to do. I'd like to be able to get fighters more opportunities elsewhere and help build them up. Because if a guy just is a superstar in Melbourne, he's always going to be that. So I want them to get opportunities, but I understand why they contract them. Because if you're going to invest in them, part of it is you want to beat everybody else, be the biggest promotion in the world. Mm. Part of it is you're investing in someone, you're building them up, and you need to get a return on your spend. It's frustrating coming into it because the sort of money that they're throwing at guys, we're not going to get that here. But at the same time, like I said, the industry can't sustain these random massive amounts of money. Like, guys getting paid more for jiu-jitsu matches every few weeks than a guy getting to be the semi-main event of a UFC fight, that's not sustainable.
Absolutely. And you brought up your Outliers promotion. So you have your Rebellion Muay Thai going on, Roots, BOA 8, you've got your 2 gyms running, Box on North, I believe, and William Street Gym.
Yep.
What's Outliers about?
So Outliers is the name of the company that we're putting above Rebellion, Roots, Bo, and all that. So
you're literally like Floyd Money, Mayweather.
So this is like the most random thing in the world, and I honestly can't explain why this book had this effect on me. My favorite book of all time is Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers. Right?
Oh, yeah, yep.
So I read that book, and for some reason it just sent me off the rails. It's
which you got held back in the football team and thrown in.
Well, I basically went, you know, it talks about explaining why people end up doing the things they do, and the circumstances. I'm like, if I hadn't moved because there was a war in Iran, and then we moved to Australia, and then I met this person, and I met these ties, I wouldn't have the opportunity to do this thing with. Like, there's this explanation of all these things that have happened to my life. So that book really attached to it. So, and I also think guys like William Liu, my photographer, and Tom Gathicol, my videographer, they are outliers. They're not normal dudes.
No, they're phenomenal.
Freaks. Like, you can...
That's the thing. I don't think you will struggle to find some classier and higher fidelity, higher quality photography in a fight sport than that.
Yeah, they're phenomenal. And like, I get asked all the time, guys saying, can I come and photograph your show? I'm such a control freak. I'm like, anyone who's not there, if you're there, I can control what you see. If you're not there, yeah, I'm still going to control what you see of Rebellion. You're going to see what Will takes and what Tom puts together. Mm-hmm. And it's what represents my show, because I don't want your dodgy Instagram photo of it,
yeah.
Right? So that's why the Outliers thing happened. And I don't know how, what time-wise, but I do want to run some different fight sports events as well. I kind of want to get into not professional boxing, but the sort of pro-am style events,
right,
which is still kind of the amateur style and without the dodginess of pro boxing, but the Rebellion sort of feel, and I want to be involved in it. I want to run a big fight festival, and I think Outliers is what kind of covers that.
Right, excellent.
And I just like coming up with names and brands.
Yeah, yeah. More things for your LinkedIn profile. So have you considered a foray into the MMA world?
People ask me super regularly, like everyone, and every few months I'm like, I want to talk to you about something. And there's a couple of things. Same with the pro boxing culture a little bit. I kind of struggle with the MMA culture a little.
Mm.
What is it specifically?
Jiu-jitsu, I think the guys who come and watch jiu-jitsu are like, they love jiu-jitsu. They train jiu-jitsu. They do it. Essentially with the Muay Thai thing too, I find I'm dealing with like...
Martial UFC, artists.
Yeah, martial artists. UFC, so MMA.
A lot more mainstream, MMA. So.
Yeah, MMA, kind of different, and I find that people just kind of want to see that whole being in the cage thing, Was I still like pride?
Right. I mean, I don't know what it is about pride. I mean, for me, pride, it was obviously incredible. I mean, the ring worked, but it was more, again, about that spectacle. It was just...
Exactly. Yep. And it sounds super conceited, but I think I could have a shot at doing the greatest Muay Thai show in the world.
Right.
And I think I could do the... potentially one of the greatest jiu-jitsu event in the world.
Yep.
I don't think I'm ever going to beat the UFC.
I'm not making any claim to fame with jiu-jitsu, but you know, I've competed at some of the biggest tournaments like the Abu Dhabi World Pro, which I consider one of the greatest sort of spectacles to watch in terms of professionalism and the way it's run.
Happening right now.
Yeah, exactly. It's happening today. You know, sort of shout out to Livia, who's in the final soon. So,
yeah, go Liv.
And you know, I've actually been, and as a jiu-jitsu fan, I've like, you know, basically been on the pilgrimage to go to some of these world championships, and I'm telling you, Boa 8 is, I don't put anything against it.
Oh, awesome,
it's incredible.
Thank you.
So absolutely believe you that you can put on some of these great shows.
Yeah, and that's, you know, like, it probably won't ever, no one will ever go, this is the greatest Muay Thai. Like, I got a few friends who's been around and I go, this is the best Muay Thai thing we've been to, but I'm like, I don't feel it's that way, and if it was, I'd be like, all right, I'm done. But like, that's an aspiration that it's achievable, but it might never happen, whereas I'm never going to get bigger than the UFC or run a better event. I think they do it for MMA, what MMA is now. They do it better than anyone, and people can try. Like, I think Bellator tries, but Bellator gets recycled UFC fighters and tries to do that. And I'm like, and my idea of what it should be, I don't think I'm going to... It might happen one day. Like, people... ask me enough, I might do something, but it's not something that like super duper interests me. And I think as far as the competition and fight scene, I think there's more MMA fans than competitors and athletes. Like, we had it at our gyms before where people come and do it, but they still want to do jiu-jitsu or Muay Thai or boxing.
And I find that funny as well. I mean, like, you look at MMA, you know, we look at our gym, Absolute MMA, we're producing world champions in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. It's a very different thing. So as far as your production and this aspiration, what do you need to sort of take these events to the next level? What are you thinking? What are you envisioning?
Look, one of the big parts is what I said about with Tom. Like, I guess our thing with Outliers and Fight Sports is we don't want to be just individual single events. We want to be a thing.
Yeah.
That being sort of like, if you think about Vice on YouTube, Vice Magazine of Fight Sports, we go and do a lot of content on fighters. Like, we want the events to be part of a thing, not the events be the thing where everything else builds up to.
Right.
So I want people to
be like a journey.
Yeah. And, you know, I said to Tom, I'm like, man, I want to have a thing on Rebellion on Netflix one day. I want to have a reality thing about it. I want people to see the fighters, because it's like, when it comes to professional boxing, I look forward more to the HBO 24/7 lead-up series than the actual fights. And, like, that draws me in. Like, the classic Ultimate Fighter thing with UFC. UFC blew up because of the Ultimate Fighter. And the tournaments, you can come in... The tournaments are a perfect example of that, because you can come into Rebellion and not know anything about Muay Thai. And when we do those 8-mans at the end of the year, watch the first round and you got a fan favorite that like you love by the end of it, because you see that story develop.
Absolutely.
Same with Boa. Like, you'll come into it and you'll go, I don't know who these guys are. And by the end of it, you got a guy that you're the biggest fan of. You saw him, you saw his story develop. And then if we can get some background content in that and mix it into it, I think it makes a really interesting story. Because fighters, you know, they've got, you know, even some of the interviews we've gone and done, people have all this other stuff going on that, you know, like, we all get into martial arts for some other reason, right? There's something else, there's some other question you're trying to answer. And once you get that story and then how it comes in with the actual combat and then the afterwards, it's super, super duper interesting. And just there's a whole lot to, like, what you guys do with strength conditioning for sports and stuff. There's just so much to this the world we have. And I think the better we can do every bit of this, the more it's all going to grow for everyone. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, I don't think you need to be the only promotion in the world. I don't think you should be the strongest gym in the world. Because if you're the only big, strong gym in a city, who are you competing against? How Absolutely. Are you going to get better?
Yeah.
You know, so we need the whole industry to get more professional and grow bigger. And for me to get bigger events, I got to be at a point where I can call up a venue and not have to spend 4 years trying to convince them to let a fight show in there because they think we're all dodgy. Like St. Kilda Town Hall, where I did my shows, 4 years it took for me to get in there because they're like, we don't want fight sports. I did Boa at St. National Theatre. They wrote me the nicest letter going, so professional. St. Kilda's like, okay, cool. You're not a criminal.
Amazing. Amazing.
So we need all of those things growing. Like what you guys are doing, you need a culture around it, and we all have to fill that culture up.
Mm.
So, and not everybody just about themselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, we talk about it being an entertainment industry, but it's the stories that fans come along on the journey for. I mean, you know, when it comes to a fighter, it's more than just getting in the cage and or the ring and slugging at each other. It's a, you know, the motivations, the triggers. Like, what is the story? Like, why are you inspired to be a fighter? Is it the paycheck, or is it the fact that, you know, you want to be in front of a crowd and, you know, soak all that up?
Yeah, and it is. And it's like there's different martial arts and different fight sports, but a lot of the threads can be the same. There's some things that are culturally very different. Like, so I deal with some of the Brazilian guys for Boa, and then I deal with Thai guys in for Muay Thai, and it's a different thing. But then there's similar. It's a lot of interesting stuff you can just learn about culture from people. Like for me, the funniest thing in the world is I talk to Muay Thai people on Line Messenger, and I talk to Jiu-Jitsu people on WhatsApp. It's like, but just what's more popular? It's just weird things. One guy, like the first conversation you have about him is money. The other ones, the first conversation you have about is where they're staying. It's so interesting, and if you can capture that and curate, like it's we've got an interesting sort of industry that's a lot of times misrepresented by people's outside perception. And I think UFC probably shows a different side of it, right? So like the whole throwing a trolley through a window thing, it's like if someone did that fighting for Rebellion and they were selling 1,000 tickets, I'd still sack them. Like it's just you're a fucking criminal. Yep. We don't need that.
Yeah,
it's a different thing, but there's so much to it. There's so many cool things that can come out of it.
Mm. I mean, exactly. And you mentioned something earlier about obviously, you know, you needing that healthy competition to sort of foster that competition that I guess drives a better outcome in the end. You know, what are your thoughts on something like the UFC? Should it, you know, being a monopoly at this stage, do we need more organizations out there helping raise that bar?
It's two-sided. Like I've had this running joke with Tom where I go, I kind of feel like there should be like a dictatorship of 4 years with Muay Thai where I can just make sure everything's right. I'm like, Pol Pot probably thought that too, but then like it started punishing people, right? But I think like you kind of needed that single-minded, strong organization to grow MMA to what it's become, because like there's guys now that don't know really what UFC was. They don't know what jiu-jitsu was, right? Like, and these guys have grown it at that early stages. You needed those, like, but now I think, and it's going to be very hard because they're such a powerhouse.
Yeah,
you need competition because, end of the day, when you say this guy is the champion of the world, it's like the NBA. You're the basketball champion of an American organization, right?
American football, whether it's at World Series. Yeah, like, who are they competing with?
Even here, there's Muay Thai shows in Australia go, oh, you're the blah, 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 world champion. Or the Lion Fight world champion. It's like, it's not really a world world champion. For the UFC, because they contract the fighters, they run the promotion and they're the sanctioning body, you can actually say that's a true thing of a world champion. So for the sport to have a genuinely, I mean, I don't think there's anyone better than the current UFC champion, but for it to open up, be a global sport, you probably do need those challenges and other events coming up, but it's just going to be super difficult because they've got the brand name and they're already positioned there and they've got the biggest part of the market.
Yeah. Absolutely. So you've mentioned you've got a few other interesting things on the horizon. You've got this Netflix potential thing going on.
We don't have anything with Netflix. That's our aspiration.
And noble aspirations.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. You know, for the Netflix employees listening, so that little plug there.
Yeah. So I can stop running Facebook ads against you.
So what else is on the horizon, Si?
So I've got the two gyms, William Street Gym and Box on North, which we just started, which is the world's smallest boxing gym.
Where is that? Sorry, on North?
In North Road, Ormond.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So that's growing slowly. And then my gym, I still teach 20, 30 hours a week, boxing class and stuff there.
Just because you haven't got enough to do.
Yeah. Well, and we've got just general people training, and then we've got a few people fighting. And last night we had a guy get screwed over by a referee in a professional boxing fight. Wow. That doesn't matter. But so I've got that going on. And then the events, so Boa and Rebellion and Roots and whatever else may come. And I guess the most exciting thing is for me is the stuff we're doing with Tom, because, you know, when I was at uni, I wanted to be a journalist, but I wanted to be a lawyer. I don't want to be a journalist and walk down. But I think with his ability to film and storytell and my ability to drive him to the places, we can make some cool stuff happening there. Yeah, like I'd love to get some really good quality, in-depth sort of content out about fighters and grapplers and Thai boxers and boxers and the coaches. Like, you know, we're going to only do Muay Thai stuff and a bit of jiu-jitsu, but then I said, oh man, I want to go. Someone should go and talk to my old wrestling coach, Sam Parker, for half an hour, because that dude's been around forever. Mm. And it's and he's sometimes not the easiest person to get along with, always going, but he's got so many stories. And there's, you know, boxing trainers and stuff in Melbourne, and that's just Melbourne. There's all these guys with history. So we want to get into that, but there's obviously time restrictions at the moment because we've got so many things coming up that we've got to focus on. But that's the other part of things we want to get into. So I mentioned to you guys before we jumped on, we started doing a Muay Thai podcast. Been in the talks forever, so we've just recorded three of those and we'll hopefully get those on YouTube. Yeah.
Awesome. What is it called?
We're probably going to muck it around a little bit. So we're going to use it as the Rebellion podcast to start with. But if it ends up being other fight sports involved too, it's going to go along the Outliers of Combat sort of thing. So
Reboa.
Yeah. There's you know, last time we were at this fight show and Judd Reed is there. And like Judd, my Irish boxer that fought was asking me about, he's like, you ever seen that Kumite thing where they fight each other 100 rounds? I'm like, yeah, it's pretty badass. And then we show up to the changing rooms and we're sitting there, and then Judd Reed is there, and Judd's like one of three non-Japanese that's ever done it, one of seven people. I'm like, that dude did the 100-man kumite. He was a Uchideshi under Masayama. Like, he was a living student with the founder. So he'd be really interesting. Like, John Will, I trained with him when I was 16. He's like one of the people that influenced me the most as far as getting into, like, teaching stuff. I'd love to sit there and, like, talk. There's a lot of people, so I don't know where
Absolutely,
it's going to
go. He's you know, one of the... Is he one of the Dirty Dozen, I believe, from
Australia?
Yeah, obviously, and Dirty Dozen being a big thing in Australia, being 12 of essentially the pioneering jiu-jitsu legends who helped bring jiu-jitsu into Australia and popularise it. Amazing. Definitely a guy to sit down and talk to.
Yeah. John Will's
on our horizon as well.
He's one of the most referenced guys I think we've had on this show. Yep. Well, I mean, we haven't had him on the show, but we've spoken about him more times than anybody else.
It's funny, like, I look back and I think two of the people, sports-wise, that really influenced me were my PE teacher in high school and then John Will, because I was, like, 16 when I started doing what was called shoot fighting back then. Mm-hmm. And just remember the energy difference between when he taught a class and when other people did. And I realized really early on that I was going to be more of a coach than a competitor. Mm. There was pivotal points, and I think he really, his style and his energy... He's got a very unique charisma when he teaches class. Appeal to him. We've all been in those classes. It was like, yeah, you just, this is not working. And he's a really phenomenal dude. And he's just his history and in martial arts is phenomenal.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. So I really, really appreciated you coming on.
My pleasure.
Anything else we've missed out?
No, I think I've talked your ears off, but thank you so much for doing this, and
absolute pleasure, man.
Helping get the word out for Boa, so hopefully it's going to be a lot more regular than once every 3 years.
Please.
Yeah, look, you know, we'll see how this next one goes, but the plan is to get a couple out a year and really try to do some cool stuff. So
excellent. So how can people get tickets to Boa 8?
If you jump on the website, boasuper8.com, there's a link there. I keep sharing it on Instagram and stuff as well. But, yeah, we opened up the ticketing on Tuesday night, and like all the front row tickets and most of the table seating and some of the other stuff is gone, so it's been a really good response.
It's a good sign.
Yeah, yeah, it has been. So, yeah, guys, like, please come and support the event, because for it to happen, we need those people there. Mm-hmm. And then if you want to compete in the Open, it's on BJJ Comps, Boa Open. Jump in, get in that. It'll be a well-run event. It'll be a tournament. But
yeah, website, by the way, that's bjjcomp.com. So.
Yeah, yeah. So Pat and Anton have been really awesome helping organize that, and Zebra Mats has jumped on board for getting the mats and stuff.
That's great.
Yeah, Pat's been awesome with that. So that tournament, that whole day, it's going to be a jiu-jitsu festival. So like jiu-jitsu during the day, then your normal tournament building up to this thing, sort of like an Australian Open type thing where you got the center court and then the Amazing. Outside court. So yeah, if you're keen to compete, come in. We'll make sure it's as well as a comp's going to run, and try to have good food and all that sort of stuff there. And then May 26th, I'll put up details for that as well, the Challenger Series. And yeah, guys, if there's any super fights you want to see on the Challenger Series, inbox the Boa Facebook page or my Instagram, Boa, one of my 17 Instagram pages, Boa Super 8.
I'm sure there'll be a flood of suggestions.
I know. 11 of which, the first 11 will be Borac. Like, is there anyone else you want to see Borac go with?
I've competed against him once, so yeah.
Yeah.
Brenton versus Borac.
Brenton versus Borac.
Oh, yeah. Awesome. Thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you very much. Thanks for your time.
Awesome. Cheers. Cheers.